This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
As most of you know, you have come out not only to hear Linda Hogan, but to participate in an ongoing part of the Whitworth academic and intellectual life. This is the Simpson Duvall Lecture, and some of you probably knew Professors Simpson and Duvall. Clem Simpson, Clarence officially, was a professor of English here from 1953 until his retirement in 1980. And Fenton Duvall was in the history department from 1949 till 1981. And during the course of that time, the two professors were at the center of a lot of what went on campus. They are the originators, or they're the moving force behind and shapers of the core program. They were part of the development of the off-campus Jan-term study tours, other things like that. They played other roles, including being dean of men and acting president, things like that. And so as a recognition of their contributions to the life at Whitworth, this endowment has been established that allows us to bring significant scholars and writers from the history or the English side of things, and it alternates from year to year. And so this year we have gone to Tishomingo, Oklahoma to bring our reader. Linda Hogan is writer in residence for the Chickasaw Nation. She's engaged at present in a 3-year project researching and writing about the history, the prehistory, the traditions, and the culture of the Chickasaw people. She's a poet, she's an essayist, she's a playwright, she's a novelist, she is an editor, she is a memoir writer, she's done a lot of things connected with words. And as my students in the Native American literature class have discovered by reading Solar Storms, she is an exquisite stylist and admitted today in class that it's because she actually is a poet first, and so she keeps writing like she's a poet even when she's got great big long sentences and stuff like that. So we have asked her to come and present as this year's Simpson Duvall lecturer, so please welcome Linda Hogan.
Thank you, and thanks for showing up. And do I really write long sentences? I'm really curious to know that now. I always like to acknowledge the land we're on and the people who originated here. And I'm not sure who the first people were in this area. I'm not familiar with this region, but I'm grateful to be here. And thank you for inviting me. I do history as well as writing, but mostly I love to write, and I think I will start out reading a few things from, I was thinking about reading from Solar Storms. How many of the students are here that are reading Solar Storms? Not very many. Well, I'm going to read a few things for you, those of you who are here reading Solar Storms. From the book, I thought you were reading, when I was invited, I thought you were reading People of the Whale, which is from this region. And so let me just read a little bit from the book for you so you hear the voice of the people. And this is the ice bear, the blue bear, blue-white bear that was found in California. Most of this is based on truth, even though it's in fiction form. And it was one of the last of this kind of glacier bear that was found. And it was put in a cage eventually and then used as entertainment and, you know, treated badly to make money for the people that, quote, owned it. And so Agnes is talking about this bear. And actually, you don't know the process that writers go through, but sometimes I always told my students when I taught at the university, I now work for my own tribal nation, but I'm a Chickasaw, and I do live in Tishomingo. It means Tish means medicine, and it also means peace. And Tishomingo, Mingo means king or chief. So Tishomingo means medicine leader or medicine peace chief, or however you, whichever interpretation you would add to that. And it's the capital of our nation. And I spent a lot of time tonight talking about what we don't have there. we don't have like a Starbucks. We don't have any restaurants. We don't have anything really much except for some cattle once in a while and things like that passing through. And it's really pretty much out in the middle of nowhere, but beautiful country. And with places where the land in Oklahoma has mountains that are so old that they're actually underground because the land has moved over the years over them. And, of course, the Dust Bowl probably contributed to that. I don't really know how underground they were before that. But. Agnes is one of the elders in the book. The book is about generations of women. It's hard to talk, to read from it for people who haven't read it, but I'm going to try anyway. So this is a section about the bear. And Agnes is telling the story. The bear was the color of ice. It was the last of its kind. It still makes me sad. It wandered down to California. No one knew why it was so far from home. But it hid out and it lived. It was the mother, they say, of their twin cubs. There were tribes of bears in those days. They were around for thousands of years, clear back to when we lived by the laws of nature. A bear could only be killed at a certain time of the year, and that was for meat and medicine and fur. Even then, it was a rare thing when an Indian killed a bear because bears resemble men. There was a Frenchman, Beauregard. He went out west to find the last of the beaver. They were mostly gone here. But it was too late. Even in California, they were gone. When he saw the bear, he trapped it and took it captive. At first, he used it to fight dogs. The men made bets on who would win. They kept it awake all year. That's against bear nature. Its poor mind was no longer sane, and its diet was bad, so its teeth went bad, and it went weak, and some of its fur fell out in patches. Then they tried to make money by letting men wrestle the poor creature. Finally, they charged people money just to come and see it, the last one, the last glacier bear. They always loved the last of anything. These men, even the last people, I guess they felt safe then when it was all gone. Agnes was only 12, that's the girl, when they brought the bear, blue bear here. She was plump and beautiful, my girl. She was round as fruit on a tree, and from the first minute she saw that bear, she loved it. It was a special thing, her and that bear. Every day she went to look at it. For a penny, they'd let her see it. A minute, a penny. Some days she took 30 pennies. When Beauregard saw how good she was with it, he hired her to feed it. He was afraid of it, you know. The other men, too, afraid of that poor broken thing. When they went in the small cage, they kicked it away and pushed at it with their rifles. But Agnes was not afraid, and she was a gentle girl. The bear liked this. It knew her, in a way, through her eyes, I think. She stole good food for it, too, and its fur grew back. In the afternoons, young boys would go around and poke sticks through the cage, and Agnes would fight with the boys and come home crying. Looking back on it, the boys, I think they were jealous of what's wild and strong. If the bear fought back, it was hated, And if it didn't, it was hated for being weak. And that bear was ruined in its heart. Even with Agnes' love, it sat with its back to the boys and let them poke it and call it names. And finally, they came to it with guns full of corn, and they shot that poor bear to see if it had any fight left in its thick skin. Antagonizing it that way, Agnes cried and kicked them. She chased after them. They called her crazy. "I'll shoot you," she said. "That's how crazy I am." She took a gun one day to keep them away. It was really just for show, the gun. But I had to get after her for taking it, and I hid it after that. One chilly day alone, she went to the bear. She lifted her shirt and showed the bear her round, full breasts. Oh, it understood already. It knew she was a woman, and it knew she had compassion. Before she left the house that day, I saw her crying. I had a bad feeling. I followed her. I watched how she entered the cage. She didn't even fear for her own life. She didn't have the gun. She only had a knife, so all the poor girl had to do was to cut the bear's neck and let it bleed. She did it fast before I saw what was happening, before I could stop her. The warm blood poured into the ground. It was a chilly day. You could see the steam rise from the wounds. Its eyes were grateful. I saw that. She stroked the big animal. I saw it with my own eyes. That bear put a paw on Agnes and stroked her in return. It touched her. It comforted her. I have never seen such a thing as that. I cried too. When all the life had flowed out of it, Agnes took the life and slid it under the skin. I went to her. "What are you doing?" I said, but she didn't answer me. She knew I'd been there all along and that I was crying. It was hard work to skin and quarter the bear. She removed the liver, the heart. She knew that bear inch by inch, where every muscle joined bone. "Don't just stand there," she told me. "Help me out." She was bossy like that, even when she was young. "Go get the wagon," she said, "and hurry before they get back." The men, she meant. I did as she said. I followed her orders. I rushed home, and as I left, I heard her singing a bear song no one had sung since I was a girl, an old, old song. I went and got another knife and the bouncing wagon, and when I went back, I helped pull the fur away from the flesh. I still remember the bones of the foot. 4 wagon loads we brought back, bumping all the way. That night, after dark, the Frenchman and his friend came knocking at our door. They knocked loud. They wanted the meat. Those men pushed their way into the house. "Get out," I yelled at them, but I was scared of them. I fell back against the table. We were just women there. We had no men to protect us. They wanted the fur, too. It was a rare color for a bear. It would catch them a good price. Agnes had already pinned it. "Give me that," Beauregard said. He took it from her. Agnes stood up to him. I couldn't believe my own eyes and ears. There were times I thought she was so stubborn, that girl. But this time I was proud of her. She stood up to him. She said, "It's all right. This fur belongs to me, but you go ahead and take it. I'll wait for you to die. You won't last long. But me, I have time." Not even a year later, he died. While his woman grieved, Agnes stole into his house through a window, and she threw the coat out onto the snow. I picked it up. She conned me into it, her crime, you see. I was under the window waiting, even though I was afraid of what would happen if we got caught. Agnes wore the nightmare. That's what I called the coat. First thing every morning, Agnes brushed the fur, rocking it in the chair, her dark hair around her plump shoulders, like it was a baby, and talking and singing things. To this day, I don't know where she got it all, meaning the knowledge. By then, the land was settled. No bears were there to disturb the people. But at night in the woods, settlers heard branches snap. They heard the breathing in the forest. The bear lived there, and it lived inside their own skin and bones. Everything they feared moved right inside them. Agnes wanted to know, always, why some men will do what they do. She believed wearing its skin would show her these things. Sometimes it happens that at twilight, I see those eyes and that large paw brushing Agnes' back, and I hear her sing, and I get a feeling, just a feeling. Agnes is becoming something. Maybe the bear. Maybe she knows her way back to something. You don't realize what nobody ever thinks about what writers don't use in their books, but there was a very long chapter that was on this bear coat, and that Agnes, she had a son, and he stole it. It's not in the book. I couldn't make it work right, so it's not there. But, you know, it's just funny, because when you're finished with the book, it looks kind of whole, and it looks kind of like, oh, everything's together, so you don't think that the writer has a whole notebook full of something they didn't use, things that couldn't work. This is, by the way, a set in the north, in case you didn't already notice. And it is true that the beaver were extinct, nearly extinct from, they were used for making hats that were sent, they were sent to Europe to make felted wool hats. And beaver hats were really in style in Europe. So there were almost a few hundred men that nearly extincted an entire species in the country during the fur trade up in the north. And the fur trade actually started in the 17th century and continued on in for a very long time, and probably some of it still continues on. There's still people who use leg hold traps in different places. Some states have them outlawed and some don't. So I just thought I'd throw this one in because it's, I didn't know how many just men would be here, but I like this because it's so different. You know, men and women are very different in their conversations and, you know, like just how they speak. So the men spoke in different ways from the women. Their conversations went something like this. Have you ever caught a bluefish? Those are something else. They go out, about 100 yards and you have to bring them back. They've got a lot of teeth. They look kind of like tuna or something. Yeah, and they give you a good battle. Fish stories, and they talked out loud. I fished until 4 a.m, one would say, and I didn't catch a thing. Now, I know this probably meant he'd caught so many he wanted to keep the place a secret. That's how they talked, in a circular fashion. Next time, let's take some bacon. I heard they really strike at that. Yeah, or salmon eggs. They like them, too. Where is Devil's Lake, anyway? My uncle went there, and he did really good. Red Hots, I hear they bite at those, too. Is that the uncle that got struck by lightning 3 times? In the living room, which doubled as my bedroom, this is the main character speaking, the teapot sat on the old gold-painted sewing machine, and the women talked with one another. They talked about the deepest things, the most meaningful of subjects, about love and tragedy. Frenchie said she'd once loved a younger man. Agnes said she still thought of her son Harold and what had come of him. Dora Rouge, the oldest woman, propped up next to me on the cot, said, "I want to go home to die. It's my dream. It is so beautiful there. When I was young, the northern lights would dance, really dance across the sky. They were so close to us. When we saw them, we'd say, 'Here comes sky on its many trails.'" I love to listen to the men talk, and when I go to coffee shops where men are, I like to listen to their conversations because they're so completely different. When women get together, we really, really talk about intimate things, and the men are sitting there in their groups saying, "You remember that squirrel I shot that year?" And he said the same story, you know, maybe 50 times. At the first light of morning, I sat up in bed. The storm by then was dark green, and there was a still, a rhythmic sound of falling water, but a larger noise was behind the rain, a great disturbance of air. I went to the window and looked up. In the first spread of light above us was a cloud, a great cloud of fish, flesh, and feathers so thick, the sky itself appeared to be moving as the wings of tundra swans clattered together as they pulled themselves south. Their voices seemed to wake the land itself, which at that moment lived only for the great, beautiful birds, the sky full and moving. I wasn't dreaming. I had no need to dream. This world I'd entered, however strange, was dream enough, with its dark roots, its instinctual light and full sky. I had traveled long and hard to be there. I'd searched all my life for this older world that was lost to me, this world only my body remembered. In that moment, I understood I was part of the same equation as birds and rain. That's Angel speaking. She's the speaker of the book. And since most of you haven't read this book and only a few of you are in your class, I'll just say that it's dedicated to Danielle, who was my granddaughter. And I lost her because my daughter, I adopted my daughter, my oldest daughter, when she was 10 years old. And she had a lot of abuse problems from earlier and other kinds of things and going on. And she gave her granddaughter up, her daughter up for adoption. But she had lived with me part of the time, and so we were bonded already. And so it was heartbreaking for me. And there were no grandparents' rights at the time. And I was single, and I didn't have a good income. So I wouldn't even have been considered by the county to be a good parent for this granddaughter that I was so bonded to and loved so much. And so I wrote this book partly thinking someday my granddaughter Danielle Marie is going to be, maybe she'll be in school and maybe she'll be in her 30s, I don't know, but maybe she'll read this book and she'll, you know, come looking for me because she sees it's for her. And so about 8 years later, well, when she was about 8 years old, I guess, so it was less than 8 years, I was at work one day, and I got a telephone call from this woman. She said, "You don't know me. My name is Kathy, but I just finished your book, and I just want you to know I have Danielle Marie." So the woman who adopted her, the family that adopted her, called me, and I went over to their, I called my other daughter, and we were really excited, and we went over to their house for dinner that night, and Danielle and I were still bonded. We still had that bond after all those years of being separated. It was just incredible. When she was going through those rotten teenage years, I was the only person that could walk in the rooms when she would shut the doors, slam the doors, and, you know, all those things girls do at that age. And I could walk in and I'd say things like, I knew you before anybody else. You can't throw me out, you know. And she wouldn't. She'd start laughing. And so now she has her, she's an adult and she works and goes to school and she has a child. So I'm a great grandmother of my great granddaughter, Jana. And so it's been a real experience to go through losing this child from my life that meant so much and then having her back and still having her. And in the meantime, they had a biological daughter the same age as Danielle that was interested in everything I was interested in. And so she and I are kind of like close friends. She calls me all the time and we talk about, when we're with the family, they get very, they just don't grasp what we're talking about because we're interested in nature and we talk about mosses and lichens and all these things. And everybody's just looking, you know, drinking coffee and looking at each other like, oh, you know, what's wrong with these nature girls, you know? So when she was 12 years old, she wanted to be a marine biologist, and she knew it all her life what she was going to do. And then in high school, ended up working out on the water with marine biologists and getting some credits for it, and she's still at it. And I ended up doing marine biology work. I did a book on gray whales for National Geographic, and then did a book called People of the Whale, which is set in the Northwest, and actually was the book I was prepared to read from tonight because that's what I thought you were teaching. I don't know why I thought that, but I did. So I'm going to read some other things to you because since you haven't read that book, it's a little bit difficult to. I'm going to come back to it and read just a little bit, little pieces from it once in a while, but I'll read some other things that might be interesting to you. I work in a lot of different areas. I work as a writer and I do ecological and environmental work and native knowledge, indigenous knowledge, and native science. So for about 20 years, I've been working with native science in a group in Canada that was started by the physicist David Bohm back when he was alive. And so I think along about all the different kinds of knowledge that we have in the world and the different things that we don't pay attention to, that we don't really grasp, and how we don't know we have these unfathomable kinships with the natural world that we on a day-to-day basis don't know and grasp and how significant they are. So the nice thing about being a writer is that I can do the research, the kind of research I want. If I want to do books on whales, I can, and if I want to study ants, I can and have. And but the main thing that I think of when I'm working is how in our way of thinking about the world today that we've come to a wall where we need a new way of thinking, and we know we need a new way of thinking, but there's some reason or something we can't get over, like a wall we can't quite get over to get to that new way of thinking, so that we can make a difference and make the world, you know, help make the world the kind of place we want it to get back to being. And so we, you know, Lauren Lyons, who's now an elder in Six Nations, said that, you know, we humans live somewhere between the mountain and the ant, there and only there as part and parcel of creation. And I think what he says is important, that we don't know our human place within the rest of the natural world. and we are part of it. So I think a lot about how we do work on our wholeness of learning and knowledge, and how do we integrate all of the things, bring everything together so that we can see what we need to be able to do. Let me read some poems to you. My cousin, we've just worked on a performance that for our tribe, and it's internationally wanted now. People are wanting to see our performance, but she's a weaver, and a lot of the time I wear her woven clothing when I give talks, but it was too heavy to carry all the things I needed with me. But she's the only non-Navajo that's ever, you don't live in the Southwest, so maybe you don't know what Indian Market is, but it's the biggest, you know, gathering of Indian artists in the country, in New Mexico every year. And she's the only non-Navajo to ever have won first place in the category of textiles. But we were weavers, and not a lot of our weaving remains behind because of the weather conditions of where we're from, the Southeast, and, you know, mildew and mold and decay and moisture. But this is called weaving, or ihi, the word for heart. We were traders spinning buffalo hair into golden threads when we lived with no bison. We wove hemp without growing it. We had shell from the west, red stone from the north, from the currents of the river, down from the open mouth, following every curve of land, knowing which trees grew. We wandered the earth we came from, the way water threads through a world between hills around a bend. Or like now, as we make our lives, spinning together the threads of historical disaster, even that fiber is spun of thread made by rubbing wool against the thigh to make the thread for weaving. This too remains how we wrote the stories of ourselves across the land, hiding at times in worlds unknown, and learning to make a way from anything. There are wars and traveling and change, but still we make a song or story, a path to the river that began as a single spring. And as we journey, we remember the first bison fur, like now, not of our place. We always make do, and when there is nothing else to weave together, we find the heart and her words. Not so very long ago, this valley was occupied by wolves, it was said. I was at the table. I was drinking coffee, drinking dark, dark coffee, thinking of those wolves that lived in this valley. And I do not lie when I tell you I had dreamed of them the night before, stealthy as they are, faces quiet, moving as slowly as ghosts, they with first title to this land of many titles. I was with my friends drinking that coffee, and we ate some bread in this place where bluebirds nest, the place where wolves lived not so very long ago. Some men went to this place, they say, and the men never came out. They killed the wolves, and then they turned from their human flesh into water, into thin air, into someone waiting for rain to fall. And when it did, they sank into the ground, all because they killed the wolves, so beautiful beyond the shallows of this river, where I sit alone now, with a glass of wine before me, the coffee all gone. In this place that was the land of wolves, it is evening now, and the leaves of trees rustle in the breeze, and soon it is early morning, and I am still sitting, and find myself in a place suddenly different in all its animal silence. These are brand new poems I'm reading to you, so you're hearing them for only the first time I've ever read them out loud. The Willow. This is my horses. I live with horses. I have one Mustang, and she's short. She's only 13 hands tall, and she had a broken pelvis when she was captured and rounded up. And then I have a 40-year-old horse that's just keeps going. She runs and everything. But she's very sweet. But the Mustang really likes to have her belly scratched. So I keep planting trees because I want to plant trees. I like to plant things. But she breaks them all off or she won't let them grow past a certain height because she likes to scratch her belly on them. So all my trees are the same height. They're just the height of her belly, everything I've planted. You know, I have a magnolia tree. It's her height, you know. She walks by. She can't walk by anything without just, like, standing there and going, you know, like this for a while. And so, I scratch her myself. It just doesn't do any good, you know. So I bought this beautiful, beautiful, one of those willows that really bend down. It's not a weeping willow. It's something else. But it was really wonderful, and it had a little nest in it from a mockingbird. And they had already fledged, and I was really thrilled. I watched them for a long time. I watched this tree over at the nursery for a long time while even the birds were in it until they fledged, and then I bought it. And so, this is called the Willow, and you can imagine what happened to it. How I loved the way its branches bent earthward, the mockingbird nest in its thick arms, the branches bending always more, and how I tried to keep the horses from eating it, but it was sweet, even the roots were chewed, and when I tasted it, the taste was all sugar. Then I understood the horses, their teeth having chewed the tree, but they even ate the mockingbird nest that once held the fledglings I so loved. They did. They even ate the nest. New wine. I have a friends, actually more than one, but a really close friend, and they're from Mongolia, where I really want to go. But there was a Mongolian sort of a cultural conference or gathering, so I went and was talked into drinking some of the mare's milk that was there. And so this is called New Wine. And you know, they put Mongolian clothes on me, and it was all a very interesting, beautiful experience. And I love the idea of just going there, living for a while in a Mongolian yurt, and, you know, although I think taking care of camels and things might be a little tough after a while, you know, now that I know about the horses and the trees. New wine. Yesterday I drank mare's milk. It was not sweet. New wine. I wondered about the foal. A friend wrapped silk robes around me, and I thought, let me love that mare, the lamb, the goat. Their cloven hooves release the smell of wild mint. Let me travel the grasses and the long green roll of the hills, before they are parched. We are parting time into different worlds where light changes. The horses run on earth toward hidden waters that look like a strand of light. I want to remain the old person I am becoming, without things too many to carry, even the books with their stories of change. Just let me do my daily chores and walk through the painted door, standing straight as I can, until the home so lovely, the decorated sticks, all come down, so many of them. And until then, all you gods and goddesses, Buddha, Allah, Great Spirit, you sin, changing woman, if a lover takes my hand, I will think it is one of you. And in the light of morning, in all our shining robes, I will bow down to that one. I wanted to put all the gods in there, but you know, there are too many. So I have the Cheyenne God, the Navajo goddess, Buddha, Allah, and the Great Spirit. I would like to read a poem called Deer Dance, which is, when I used to live in Colorado, and I lived in a wilderness preserve, really. I mean, it was the, I still keep this little area for the future because it's the last corridor, wildlife corridor in that whole area. So I actually am broke all the time because I'm supporting a wildlife corridor. I have to. But the deer used to come sometimes and sleep outside the little cabin, and I think it's because the insulation was so bad it kept them warm because it didn't keep me warm. But I also have been to many deer dances. My brother and I have a tradition every year of going to the Pueblo deer dances for Christmas. We go Christmas Day, Christmas Eve, and then the day after Christmas. And instead of having traditional turkey and all that kind of stuff, we have food from India because they don't close on Christmas. It's a restaurant that we go to in New Mexico after the dances are over. And But the thing that's so amazing to me is to be at the dances that there, the deer dances where I have an essay I wrote about it, about what it's like, people who've lived on the land for so many thousands of years and done the same dance all the time, and what it means to the people to do this dance all the time, every year, at a certain time of the year, and to everyone shows up to dance, and it's just, it's incredibly beautiful to be there. At one of the deer dances, there are two mountains, and you're there before dawn, before the sun comes up. And just as the sun comes up, there is the sound of noise behind these two mountains. And then on top of the mountains appears what looks like a big deer with antlers, only it's not a deer, it's a man. And he has two sticks so that he looks like he's walking like a deer. And then on the next mountain is another big deer man. And they walk down the mountain with those sticks, which is actually very difficult. And then the other animals come around the hills, and it's kind of loud for a while. And then they dance, and everybody comes and dances. And the thing I really love is the little kids that are deer, you know, because they're really cute and they don't understand the tradition behind it yet, so they're kind of making little mistakes. But some of the dancers are quite complex moves that it would take a long time to learn. But this is another deer dance, and it's at the Yaqui Pueblo. And so one April, it's in April every year, we went to the deer dance. And if you look in the library under Yaqui deer dances, you'll find volumes and volumes of material because they're so elaborate. The songs and the stories that go with the Yaqui deer dance are extremely elaborate. And it's a story of enchantment. It's a story of a deer in spring coming out of the forest. And they used to be forest people, although they now, since the Spanish came and conquered them, they live in the desert because they've been lost from their own land. But it's about the first deer of spring coming out of the forest with flowers, wildflowers in its antlers. And it's the stories are beautiful, and it's a cycle, and it goes on quite a bit. So I put the two together, and they came together in my mind. So this is deer dance. This morning, when the chill that rises up from the ground is warm, the snow is melted where the small deer slept. See how the bodies leave their marks. The snow reveals their paths on the hillsides, the white overcrossing pathways into the upper meadows, where water comes forth and streams begin. With the new snow, the unseen becomes seen. Rivers begin this way. At the deer dance last year, after the clashing forces of human good and evil, the men dressed in black, the human women mourning for what was gone, the evergreen sprigs carried in a circle to show the return of spring. That night, after everything human was resolved, a young man, the chosen, became the deer. In the white skin of its ancestors, wearing the head of the deer above the human head, with flowers in his antlers, he danced, beautiful and tireless, until he was more than human, until he too was deer. Of all those who were transformed into animals, the traveler Circe turned into pigs, the woman who became the bear, the girl who always remained the child of wolves, none of them wanted to go back to being human. And I would do it too, leave off being human and become what it was that slept outside my door last night. One evening I hid in the brush south of here and watched at the place where they shed their antlers. And where the deer danced, it was true, as my old grandmother said, water came up from the ground, and I could hear them breathing at the crooked river. The road there, I know, I live here, and always when I walk it, they are not quite sure of me, looking back now and then to see that I am still far enough away. Their gray-brown bodies, the scars of fences, the fur never quite straight, as if they just stepped into it. You know how they look with the little swirls all the time. So, well, our time is getting short, and I wanted to read time for questions and answers. Another thing I feel, I can't see the audience really well because of the lights, but I don't know how many Indigenous people are here, so some of the things that I write I feel need great explanation where they wouldn't in other locations where I am working or being. So you may have even more questions, and there are things that I might have read in other places I'm not. But in the north, the men are starting to make skin boats again instead of using the fiberglass. Is that it? Fiberglass boats? I just want to say plexiglass, but I think that's the stuff you can see through. But anyway, they are now making skin boats again. And because they're easier to maneuver, they're better for hunting and for catching, getting, you know, the caribou. But also, and someone just recently told me this, when the skin boats go through the water, they actually build up some kind of a layer across the front of them that makes them sharp almost. So they really go through the water a lot faster than I even realized, because I didn't know they built up this slick, almost icy layer of something that helps move them through the water. So I'm going to just end with this poem and let you ask me questions, and we'll have some discussion. North, watching men stretch the hide, the curve around wood, the willow shoots for ribs, as if creating a body, skin over wood, that might start to breathe, that will pass through broken waters, away from searching ravens, just like the ancestors are inside the curve of skin, moving you, saying, may you know peace. May you live in a world without weapons. And remember, as you pass through and across, wearing the skin of the animal, sitting with the tree, being the tree that life flowed through, its bare roots for now not holding tight to earth, remember the shore that surrounds a continent, the history of life, as it is spoken along the edges, thresholds of all enchanted worlds. The first ones say this, pretending to be the breaking waves. And then you can set out, crying out in all your full vigor. Okay, thank you. So I have time for questions and answers and discussions or critiques, anything. Or if you want to catch the basketball game, still, you can sneak out. I think I see a hand over there. I like handwriting, and I'm very picky about paper and pens. You know, like I have a favorite kind of pen, but I don't have one right now, so I'm always finding other pens that will... Well, you took me to the pen shop today, but I'm always in search of the right kind of pen. You know, it has to have the right feel, and I have to have the right paper. And so I handwrite, and then I type it, and then I revise it by hand, and then I type it, and, you know, back and forth 1,000 times. Yes. Yes. No. We were always going back. And I talked about this a little bit in class today, too, but my uncle started during the relocation time of the 50s, when all the Indian people were being moved off of Indian country or out of their homelands into cities. My uncle started an organization in Denver with another man to help the people that were coming in, because they were just coming in on buses and being ditched. And so they didn't have any place to go. They had no jobs. They had no place to sleep. They had no food. So they started an organization where they could just take care of people and get their needs met. So my uncle was really active in the Denver Indian community. So there, when we were in that area, I was with a lot of Navajo and Lakota people and working in a very mixed community. But we still went home to our own nation for annual meetings and for dance, the stomp dance, and other things. So I've stayed in touch, and then I've worked, you know, like for the last 20 years off and on doing jobs for the tribe, different things, writing workshops or whatever. just contract work. But no, and actually my if you Google me, there's one site that says, you know, I didn't ever live around anybody except military people, which isn't true. My father was in the Army for a while, and then he had a medical discharge because he had heart disease. But in the 1970s, when there was the occupation at Wounded Knee, which you would probably weren't born yet, but most people in the students weren't. It was a very political time for us as Indian people. And my father and I both got the Akwesasne Notes, which came out of the Mohawk Reservation. And we became very political at the same time. We became politicized about what was happening in Indian country. And then we really got serious about our traditions. So he and I started, my mother was Anglo, and I didn't know much about her family. I didn't know, I have a cousin here. I don't know if he's even here tonight or not, but I have a cousin here that I wanted to spend some time with, but I just didn't know my mother's family that well. But I knew my father's family because we were there all the time. And we were close. I mean, and then we'd have family reunions. We still do, the third week every September. It's been like forever. All my life, we'd go there the third week of September. And when I was younger, it was quite a lot of people. Now it's diminished because the older generation's gone. I am the older generation now. But it was different then, and everybody played musical instruments, fiddles and everything, and so there'd be music and everybody'd be dancing and we'd really have this wonderful time. So it's different now. It's not like that. It's not as much fun, but we just go. And so since it's not fun, I swim with the teenagers, and then I have a better time. But no, I've always stayed in touch, and I've also worked with so many other tribes that I'm aware of traditions in other areas. And my cousin runs the Native Law Center in Saskatoon, so I'm in Canada quite a bit. And his wife started an Indigenous education institute there. She had a $5.5 million grant from Canada, from the government, to start Indigenous knowledge institute. So I've learned a lot from other tribes as well. I'm sorry, that was a long answer. You're welcome. It's hard to do. It's hard to do. Well, I really started later than most people. I was in my late 20s, and I was working as a teacher's aide with handicapped children. At that time, there were thalidomide children and cerebral palsy, muscular dystrophy, and other kinds of things. And I discovered poetry that wasn't old, Edgar Allan Poe stuff. And so I got really excited, and I just started writing on my lunch hours. And then I just fell in love with writing. And so I went back to school later, and I went to the man who taught poetry at the school and asked if I could take a class. And he said yes. So, you know, and now, I mean, well, in the years since then, as I've aged, he's aged even more. And so, you know, when I'm in that area, we always get together and have dinner and visit for a while, you know, so it's kind of neat. But it's like you either love to write and you want to do it and, you know, it's something you really care about, or if it's something that if you lose interest, just go on to something else. There are so many things to love doing. No, I don't. I never know what I'm going to do. It's always a mystery. I just start and then it happens. But if it starts to take the shape of a poem, then I know that's where it's going. But I just start out, well, I'll be taking notes on something. I'll start writing. And then pretty soon it starts to become something. It is. It's like, but you know, the thing is, I've worked in arts institutes where there are other artists, like even actors and dancers and painters and singers, or, you know, everybody says the same thing about creativity, that the act of being creative is just this magical thing where you're doing something and all of a sudden the magic happens and you go with it. And you just have to trust it. You can't do it with your brain. You do it with some other part of yourself. No, this is Agnes, and she's actually one of the grandmothers, but this is her old mother telling the story about what happened to her, how she got this bear coat. So, no, this isn't a book on Chickasaw people at all. This is a book set in the North. I just write about this. This was mostly Cree ended up being about Cree people. And actually, some people from the Cree Council of Chiefs came to talk to me and say, thank you for writing this book. It made a big difference in, you know, how we were able to work on trying to keep this dam from being built up in the far north. And but also they did a lot of work themselves. I mean, they put together museum exhibits and they traveled around everywhere showing people what these plants meant and did and where all the land was arranged by trap lines according to families, and that it wasn't just empty, barren land, but everything there was significant to the people. And so anyway, I don't really write fiction about my own people because I lived there. And if I did fiction and anything wasn't historically correct, I would just be criticized to death. So, you know, it's like I just write about other parts of the country, and I'll probably someday write something, you know, set with, you know, in our own place. But I'm waiting for the right way and the right mind and the right time. But my book Power is set in Florida, and the tribe is a made-up tribe, so that nobody can, because it's based on real events, and that way I don't have to worry about, you know, hate mail and lawsuits, that kind of thing. And then People of the Whale is a fictional tribe, and it actually has some language in it where the people are speaking, and I made up the language too. But I made it so that it worked the same kind of language throughout the book. So, you know, but you need to be careful like that. Another thing is that when people read Native literature, they think it's real. Every bit of it is real history. They don't get it that you're a writer. They think everything you write is real, true history. And a lot of times you find our fiction in the anthropology or in the history departments of bookshops, because they just can't grasp that you're, you know, that it's not true. So it's like my first book was set in Oklahoma, and it was the closest to being about us. It had a lot of our information, and it was about the oil boom. And there were people that actually came up and said, that's not really the way it happened exactly, and that the land wasn't really exactly like that. There wasn't a cave over there. And I said, you know, it's really fiction. There had to be a cave over there to make the story work, you know. So you can see the kind of problems that I would have. And plus, everybody's my cousin. I don't want them to hate me. Yes, there's a question over here. In People of the Whale, there's a lot about Vietnam and a girl that lives there who is the daughter of a man who's back in the United States, and she comes here to see him. And I did a great deal of research, and not just on the war, but on the land and the mountains, the hills, and, you know, all the way down to Cambodia. And so, I would really love to go to Vietnam. That's a part of the world I want to go to. And I hope someday I get an opportunity to do that. I'm going to be working at a writers' conference in Bali this year, and I'll be in Taiwan, but not Cambodia or Vietnam yet. Yes. Well, I went back to school after that and took a writing class, and I was writing kind of strange things compared to the other students. And so, I remember writing about where we used to live and thinking what was down there in that hole at the outhouse. And everybody couldn't relate, but Roland Flint was there visiting one time, and he related because he'd grown up with an outhouse and no electricity or plumbing and everything. So, there was a magazine, Green Mountain. Who was it that published my first book? It's like something Mountain Review. Anyway, I sent some poems there, and they said, "Do you have any more?" So I had in that time given up the outhouse poem and gone on to other things. And I sent a bunch of poems to him, and he said, "Can I publish them as a book?" And I said, "Yes." And then I realized I was going to have to, I started being invited places to give readings and realized at that point that I was going to have to go back to school, keep going to school and learning more, because people were asking me questions about things I'd never heard of. So it's just been a process since then. I can't say it's been a bad process. It's been exciting. It's been wonderful. You cannot believe the magic that happens once you start using words like that and putting them down. Yes. Yes, I'm very disciplined. I write on the weekends. I write every day, and I write from 6 o'clock in the morning till 9 o'clock when I feed the horses, and then I come back in and write some more, or edit, or do research, or whatever I need to do. So I'm very disciplined, and nobody can interrupt me. It's my sacred time, and when the children were young and they were at home, I had office hours even then where they couldn't interrupt me unless there was blood. And so they had to be quiet during that time. So, and that's another thing. I don't play music. I mean, there's no sound. It's totally silent. And my poor youngest daughter, one time she said, "Mom, there isn't really blood, but the bird got out of the cage. Somebody gave her a bird for her birthday, poor thing, poor bird. This dog came from, we had it sitting outside, and a dog came from one of the neighbor's houses and came up the hill and tried to get the bird and knocked the cage over, and the door came open, the bird flew out." And she said, "Is that good enough?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, let's go get the bird." So we were out throwing a towel over the bird to catch it. But there wasn't any blood. Okay, one more question. You're kind of quiet over here. It's hard to pay attention to this whole room at the same time. Have I found a tree? Only the big ones that were already there. You know, like oaks and, you know, big tall trees. Although I have to say that, you know, I live in Tornado Alley kind of, but we don't usually get tornadoes in Tishomingo. They mostly go through because of the angle of the land or the kind of water or something that's around there. They pass in other areas. They pass by. But a little mini tornado cell came through right by my bedroom. And it was the strangest thing because there wasn't even a windstorm. It was just thunder and lightning and rain. And so the lightning struck. I was looking out the window. And then in the next lightning, this giant tree outside just was gone, just over. And stupid me, I go running outside in the nightgown, right, you know, in the storm. You know, not thinking about that I'm going to get killed or anything, but thinking I've got to save the other tree from these branches that are laying on top of it because it's going to break too. So I'm out there trying to move these giant branches and get them off this other tree. And I did. I saved the other tree, which was good and everything. But it was just a shock to just watch something so big just go in a second. And, you know, being grateful that it didn't hit the house or something. But I have been in a situation where people call up and say, one night, one woman I work with, she's creep, so she's not my cousin. She called and she said, you know, there's a tornado heading towards you guys. You should, you know, get some mattresses and go in the closet and put the mattresses around you and all the stuff. And I was watching the news then. I turned the news on real quick. And then I said, Laura, wait a minute. It's heading to you. You know, it was heading to Wapanucka instead. So she was, and she did, it was heading towards her. So she did have to put, she and her son got mattresses and put them in the closet. And, you know, we all need tornado cellars, but we don't all have them. So that's a real estate plus out there. Well, thank you very much. You've been a good audience, and I appreciate it.